Hello, for the lore of the land, this is Jack Leffler. Today on Encounters with Consciousness, we'll hear from three great American ecologists, Garrett Hardin, Peter Warshaw, and Eleanor Ostrom. Garrett Hardin came to prominence in 1968 with the publication of his seminal essay, The Tragedy of the Commons. In December 1984, I visited Dr. Hardin at his home in Goleta, California, and asked him to talk about this essay.
I took as the example the historical instance of common pasture lands in England, which were called commons, and pointed out that those worked very well, probably for hundreds of years. And then along toward the 17th and 18th centuries, people became aware of the fact that something was wrong, that they were being overgrazed and consequently they were going downhill. And the basic reason was that when people have access to common lands on the basis of their need as they perceive it, and when the population grows to the point where the number of people exceeds the carrying capacity of the land, or the number of cows exceeds the carrying capacity of the pasture, then each person, seeking his own self-interest, will put the number of cattle he wants to on the common pasture land. And the result is that presently there are too many, and the whole thing is destroyed. Now, the reason this is a tragedy is because even after each individual realizes what is happening, he is powerless to stop it, because he says, well, if I don't get it, the pigs will. In other words, my neighbors who are pigs will get it. So I'll take mine before these pigs get there. Well, each neighbor reasons in the same way. And so although there's complete knowledge of what's happening, the deterioration is inevitable. So this is like a Greek tragedy where knowledge doesn't prevent the unfortunate end. Now, there is an escape from this, of course, and that is to get rid of the commons. And then you have two possibilities. Either you can turn it into private property, as was done in England, unjustly, I may say, the way it was done, but at least this will save the pasture land. Or you can turn it into public property, and then you have to appoint managers. And then you're at the mercy of the managers. If they manage well, it's fine, but if they don't, it isn't good. So there's no simple answer as to which one of the other systems will work better, private property, privatism, or socialism. Either one may work or either one may not work. But the one clear thing is that the commons cannot possibly work once the population has grown too great.
Over the last decades, a group of us have become involved in forwarding the notion that watersheds, such as the Colorado River watershed and the Rio Grande watershed, are themselves commons, that indeed water is a common pool resource. Over the last century, thinking of watersheds as commons has become ever more complex, especially with the growing privatization of water rights. Peter Warshaw became one of the great environmental activists. After getting his Ph.D. at Harvard, he went on to spearhead the establishing of the wastewater system in Bolinas, California, and became an editor for the Whole Earth Catalog, working closely with Stuart Brand, its founder. Here, Peter talks about how watersheds and commons in general are no longer autonomous entities.
In ecology, what you understand is that there's no closed system. And so invasions of any kind or odd events are really what move history. And so you can't create a watershed governance and think of watersheds as a closed system. They're embedded in a larger system, and the bear comes over the mountain, you know, or the fire jumps the ridge, or, you know, the rainstorm stops two watersheds down, or, you know, or the groundwater goes between the two watersheds and someone's pulling the groundwater out from underneath it and lowering the water table in your watershed, although you're in some other watershed. So Eleanor Ostrom, she was very good at pointing out that Garrett Hardin didn't understand the nature of invasion or outside disturbance upsetting the system. And that really, you know, when you go to, I've lived in Africa a long time, and you see that that's really what is the tragedy of Africa, is that people try to get it together and then a war comes in, or a 17-year drought like in Ethiopia, or, you know, or literally a plague of locusts come through. And all of a sudden, what was a system that was operating is no longer a system that's operating and jumps to another system, or has to jump, you know, or people leave.
Eleanor Ostrom received the Nobel Prize for Economics in 2009 for her masterful book, Governing the Commons. In 2011, our daughter Celestia Peregrina and I had the opportunity to record Eleanor Ostrom giving her spin on watersheds and governance.
Can people create districts that are the same size as a watershed? And in California, one of the steps that they took beyond their agreements and things of this sort is to create replenishment districts. And those are public, and they can assess a big tax. So the pump tax that pumpers in that district pay is large. So the cost of water then for households in that district is larger than many other places. And they use the money they gain to reclaim water, and they actually have a series of wells along the coast, and they inject fresh water into those wells, paid for by the tax of the people who are pulling it out. Now, that's a very complicated system, and without having some authority to create a district that can take authoritative action, if they had to wait for Sacramento to do it, they would never have been able to move ahead. They had to wait for Sacramento to approve the petition. So to get the district established, you had to, there are a lot of steps to get a right burner, get people to agree to it, and vote. And then have it approved by the legislature as an appropriate kind of district. You can't just do anything. But being able to empower yourself to put restrictions on yourself and others who share your watershed or groundwater basin is a capability that doesn't exist everywhere. California happens to have, well, there are lots of problems in California, at least the home rule tradition of California, where you could create districts that bordered the problem you're trying to solve. Most watersheds cross borders, and they don't pay any attention to institutional borders, or the institutional borders don't pay any attention to them. But if you can get a watershed protection district at the right scale, then you can have people facing up to, well, now, should we use a tax, and what kind of tax, and who should it be empowered on? How should we use the money from it? Those are tough decisions, and if you have to go to the state capital to make them, there's not local knowledge that exists in a region, even though sometimes it's got, you know, very large population, but it's at least of people who are jointly affected.
Watersheds are a great way of looking at things, and of course, when I was running utilities district, that's all you do is you think about runoff and how much water. But the problem is that water is much more complicated than a watershed. And I remember my eureka moment was in the Armagosa Basin. The Armagosa is a part of Death Valley. And when you go down the Armagosa Basin, the river actually turns around and goes into Death Valley. But if you look at the groundwater, it goes under the mountains and comes back to the headwaters. And I began to realize, okay, the invisible here is always groundwater. And it's really one of the most powerful ways that human communities, especially now with pumps, have arranged their lives for human settlement. And so that complicates watershed thinking, because watershed thinking is the surface thinking. It's how runoff on the surface goes, but it doesn't take care of the invisible. And the most sacred places on the planet, especially in the Northern Hemisphere, have been where the invisible emerges, which is springs. And so whenever you see people talking about sacredness, but there was the place where animals came together for drinking, where medicinal herbs grew best, especially mint, being a water lover, where women gathered both to wash and prepare food, And the spring, where the invisible becomes visible in water, is equally important to the watershed itself. And so that's how I would go looking for the commons. I would start at the spring and see where that emergence point is. And that's why so many of the stories are emergent points. You know, in the Hopi stories, you emerge out of the earth. It's a different, it's a little confusing why people would come from underground. Well, I think it's because life-giving water comes from underground at springs. And so you think of yourself as part of life. You come out from underground. So my watershed thought got more detailed because of groundwater, because of springs, and because also I began to see the structure of the atmosphere, of the air part, and look at fronts, and especially here where you have a front coming in from the Gulf of Mexico, a front occasionally coming in from the Sea of Cortez area, and then the Arctic fronts coming in. You have these dragons, I mean, what the Chinese would call dragons, that are fighting with each other in a way, or facing off. And some years, like this year, the Arctic dragon came all the way down. Really was great, you know, produced a beautiful spring. And we probably will delay the Gulf of Mexico dragon from coming up, and the one from the Sea of Cortez, the East Pacific, only gets into southwest New Mexico, you know, and there the Sky Island, that's the Sky Island dragon. So anyway, the complication, especially with climate change, means that when I look at anything, I definitely look at the watershed, but I also look for the springs, look for the groundwater, and look at the weather dragons. That got further complicated starting in the 20th century. In this country, it started with watershed transfers, interwatershed transfers. And now the average water to a person's home is anywhere between 100 and 1,000 miles away. And then if you do vertically, it's at least 200 feet below the surface. So again, the unholy triumvirate complicated my watershed thinking, you know, that now we're moving water between watersheds, so that if you're thinking like Lao Tzu and you're saying, how do we get human energy together with water and other kinetic energy, you know, all the other kinds of energy, heat energy, then you have to take into account that the watersheds are now connected. And you really can't go back to the commons. And what the commons is the commons is defined by the end of the pipe. So you have a Colorado River hydraulic complex commons, and anything that happens in Northern California is part of the commons of something that's going to happen in Tijuana. Anything that happens in Tucson can see anything, you know, on the west side of the watershed divide of the Colorados. And so I begin to define the techno commons, if you want to call it. Not that you forget about the natural watersheds or the groundwater or any of that, but really for political or human harmony purposes, you have to look at the techno watershed. The worst part is the electricity commons. We're all connected by that grid, so a blowout in the Midwest can turn off the electricity in Denver. I consider this the age of ignorance, not the age of information. And in the ignorance is we don't know where anything comes from. We don't know where our water comes from. We don't know where our electricity comes from. People don't know that, so they can't go back and give value to the commons that they're part of.
Decentralization is a factor, and I'm seeing from this discussion that decentralization itself is not an entire answer by any stretch. What it is bringing the two things together.
That's why more than two things. Vincent's term of polycentricity.
Polycentricity.
Yeah, because that is having governing mechanisms, small, medium, large, however many you have, so that instead of having only the big or only decentrals, which rarely work, but you are developing ways of organizing at multiple levels and then figuring out ways of interrelating. So there's some decisions that can be taken at any one of them. There are others that need to be taken at maybe three levels that coordinate.
In other words, the idea is to bring them all into play in a state of concurrency.
For some things, and give them autonomy for others. If you have to coordinate on every cotton-picking little decision, ridiculous. Well, we go back to Valencia. The realm is not the state of Spain or even a regional district. It is the individual canals for many things. But then, because there could be conflicts rapidly, they have a court system that meets every week. But that court system has autonomy and can make a decision in most instances that day. And so instead of having to wait 10 years for a court decision, you have a decision, and they may say to Farmer A, you got too much water, so next week the majordomo must take so much from you and give it to B, now.
But again, it displays the level of complexity that's evolving.
Well, and evolved from long ago, and not that it's stopped. But,
no, but I mean, but it continues.
Yeah, if you're going to have a complex interneted system like that, you've got to have multiple scales. And one of the ones that has been studied in Nepal, there are five levels. Five levels. So you go on the irrigation system from first, primary, secondary, tertiary. And there's organization at the tertiary level that takes care of certain things, like any of the canals at the tertiary level. You don't then have to go up except if there's some disaster. So they take care of that. They then choose somebody at secondary level, and then they take care of problems at that level. At the irrigation system, they take care of other things like headworks. Then there are links of them, of two or three together, and then the whole river system.
Edward Wilson wrote a book, Consilience, which I have a signed copy of. I admire a lot of his thinking, but I asked him one day if he could imagine a consilience between traditional culture bearers and biological scientists. In his book, The Future of Life, he sees indigenous wisdom as true science. Mm-hmm. What's your thought on that?
It's practical science. It is the science that comes from understanding that if you do A, B, and C, D and E will follow. And if D and E are bad, you don't do A, B, and C. But if D and E are good, aha, A, B, and C should be done. That's a different kind of science. It's practical knowledge and very, very important, and sometimes right on, frequently right on. But it's different than we spend lots and lots of time trying to figure it out and invest in labs and invest in studying. And indigenous people have rarely had the time to do all that investment. But they have had the time to try to get recording of, if you do A, B, and C, then E and F follow. So the songs, the practices, all that, then are ways of recording practical scientific knowledge.
A lot of it's based on intuition, too.
Yes.
The Navajo Community College put out a book called The Sacred. And in it, they laid out, in the simplest way, what the five principles of Native American sacredness have been. I have found that just adopting their language has really helped me bridge into the gringo white man thought. So, and again, I was the student, not the teacher. I find that especially, you know, I've been teaching at the Presidio School of Management. It's a school mostly of business people who are coming up. And I give them the five principles of that are in that book. I practically quote them. And it completely moves them. I just say, look, if you're thinking about doing any project, just like you do earth, air, fire, and water, take the five aspects of the sacred and understand that you can do, you know, Eleanor Ostrom's kind of socio-economic political system. You can do the Greek system, but you also can do the Native American thought system, which is a moral system, and morality is what is holding everything together. So when you say that everybody's my relative, what you're saying is you're going to treat everybody as your relative. The first one is that there's always a greater power that's a mystery, you know, and that you can never know power. You can never know it thoroughly, and that there's always some other power going on there. The second one is that all things are related to each other, and that there's a kinship from you and the rocks, you and the creatures, you and the people. The third one is that everything should be looked at and given its worth for its particular shape, which is the origin of the word worship. It's worth plus shape. And so it's like a kind of form of respect or honor, that you look at the worth and you look at the shape of everything and you honor it, so you worship it. And the other ones, you listen to elders, and you always listen carefully to what they are holding on to and what that legacy is about. You never interrupted. And then the fifth one was the sense of humor.
Celestia Peregrina asks the crucial question.
What do you think are the major problems that we face in this lifetime?
Obviously, global change and climate change, and I'm very concerned about it. But I'm very concerned that the way it's being thought about isn't adequate, because it's all being thought about as the impact all being global. And we're not looking at the intermediate and local impacts and what we can do. So I've written some work on polycentric approaches to global change, and arguing that when families have a family council and decide, we're using the car too much, and let's get a bike, and let's rechange how we're doing, the family can get healthier. They can actually spend less. Communities can figure out ways that they can be better off. So there are potential positive externalities at multiple scales, as well as the flow. And I'm really pushing that we do more thinking of that, so that we're just sitting around twiddling our thumbs waiting for people at an international level to make a decision, and they're having trouble. They've got all sorts of conflict. They're not doing it. So we wait. We don't take it seriously that we have a really major disaster coming down at us, and we don't do anything about it? Ridiculous.
I wonder if you could just give a little thought of your own with regard to complexity.
I'm trying to make one point on complexity. Because it's complex doesn't mean it's chaotic. A lot of social scientists, if they saw complexity, thought, oh my God, it's chaotic, get rid of it. And if you get rid of the institutional complexity, which is trying to cope with ecological complexity, that doesn't necessarily make it better. It can make it worse. Because if you get two small units and none of them operate at bigger, then they're not seeing that level. Or you get only big and no small or medium, they don't see that level. And what Herbert Simon years ago got us to understand is that you have nested systems and they aren't internally all the same structure. And that's what ecology teaches us, that little organisms inside your body, depending upon brain or heart or tummy or whatever, operate differently. Even in your body, there's not a single system. Instead of being frightened about complexity, we need to grapple with it and understand it, and then try to figure out how do we get nested institutions at the right scale that can be interacting with smaller and larger. We don't want to make people think that everything is like our body. But the nice thing about getting people to remember that the heart system and the circulation and the brain and all the rest are semi-autonomous systems, all inside a single human, then their concern about the complexity out there, you say, well, right inside a single human being, you think about the genome?
You know, when you were a naturalist at first, especially in that period of time, everything was kind of dominated by species thinking, predator, prey cycles, food webs, all that kind of stuff. And people hadn't really put together earth, air, fire, water with ecology. I mean, it hadn't gotten there yet. And then when you suddenly are first confronted by an oil spill, of course, and you see that part, but then thinking about sewage and algae and water and everything, you suddenly get the old Greek quadrangle of earth, air, fire, and water. It's actually also Hindu. And you just start thinking that way. And I still, when I give occasional teaching, I start people by saying, look, anything you look at, go through that one. Say, how is this related to earth? How is this related to water? How is this related to energy? How is this related to air? And, you know, and then when I met Luna Leopold, I began to kind of scientifically formulate that. So if you had water and earth, you got mudslides, you get swamps, you get different kinds of, and start seeing how the four work together. And it's very interesting that I think that really hurt science when elements became the periodic table. And it just divorced people from thinking about earth, just the simple elements. I mean, they're not the same, but they're made up of the same stuff. But going back there is really the basis of all. Then it became in 1973, I think that was, Nixon signed the National Environment Protection Act. And the sewage treatment plant of Bolinas was one of the first things to be analyzed under NEPA. And so we got the NEPA requirements, but no one could give us any guidelines. So a bunch of us, I mean, not just me, sat down and we went through it and we wrote probably the first environmental impact statement written on a sewage plant. Wow. But we did it, you know, just that way. We said, okay, what are the cumulative impacts? What are the, you know, near-term impacts? What are the indirect impacts? And we really just sat around. It was called Bolinas Future Studies. You know, we just sat around and thought them through, sitting outdoors, sitting around, said, well, what would be an indirect impact of this, you know? And after that, the combination of this, the Greek elements plus NEPA became the foundation of really solid environmental thinking that still gets you past environmental politics. You know, I've criticized Sierra Club as much as I've criticized oil companies because they just don't do that. They just can't, they haven't had the experience of earth, air, fire, and water in a way that they, it's part of their thinking about how to do things. So that became part of watershed consciousness as well. I mean, you know, you think about erosion, it's just a way of combining moving water with soil, you know, the top layer. I'd say that that sticks with me as one of the whole systems way of thinking. I mean, right now, everybody just channel surfs through whole systems. So there really is not a whole system. You just channel surf through them. And Eleanor Ostrom, who you just interviewed, has really the second best whole system that I used when I was an elected official, because she's asking all the time who gets a seat at the table, who gets to talk, who, what's a perverse incentive, are they voting for a perverse incentive, you know, voting for a positive incentive, are they voting for something that requires enforcement rather than incentive. And she laid that out in Governing the Commons. So you add watersheds to commons and you get into politics, those are really the major texts in a way. And, you know, and I was really lucky because of, again, through Stewart and Whole Earth being the reviewer, I would get to see these books and said, wow, this is going to help me here. And then I'd go back and practice it in the Lao Tzu way of going around and talking to every family and asking them about water.
Today, we've heard from three great environmentalists who have since departed this lifetime. Garrett Hardin died in 2003, Eleanor Ostrom died in 2012, and Peter Warshall died in 2013. We're very fortunate to still be able to listen to them discuss their thinking. Each has contributed significantly to our evolving cultural perspective regarding just how we have to shift our collective attitudes if we're going to survive. Here's a 17th century English folk poem that my friend Gary Snyder sent to me. The law locks up the man or woman who steals the goose off the commons, but leaves the greater villain loose who steals the commons from the goose. Encounters with Consciousness is a production of The Lore of the Land, funded by a grant from the Christensen Fund in San Francisco. For The Lore of the Land, this is Jack Leffler. Thank you for listening.